Before you listen to the episode, we just wanted to share a little trigger warning that we do talk about birth trauma in this episode, just so you're aware. This is really the thing of nightmares.
I thought that C-section was supposed to be 20 minutes, half an hour, maybe 40 minutes. But I was lying on that table for near to 3 hours. And the only thing I could say to anybody was Ryan. And I just kept saying, am I alive?
You were pushed to the edge of what any person can take, physically and mentally. I don't think people can ever understand what it feels like to be losing your mind.
When I came back from the hospital, where I thought I was going to be okay, but an ambulance went past and I like fully dissociated. And I was just living a life that was lost for such a long time. And I just don't even know how I got through it. Like, I really don't know how I'm here.
Could you talk us through what happened with the fire?
I knew, oh my goodness, we're in danger. This is a real fire. Because the whole house started filling with this intoxicating smoke.
What do you think that experience taught you about life?
I really think that anything is possible now, because I never thought that I would be able to find my way out of this crisis. And I have.
To find the strength somewhere, somehow, must have taken every ounce of like energy to just keep going and not give up. Welcome back to Rise with Roxy. Today's guest is someone who has had an extraordinary journey since first appearing on reality TV in 2011. Louise Thompson began her rise to fame as one of the original cast members of Made in Chelsea. Louise then started the clothing brand Pocket and the health app Turtle before experiencing a life-altering traumatic birth and a whole host of health complications that set her life on a completely different trajectory. I listened to her audiobook Lucky last year and I was so moved by it. I was either in tears or had my jaw on the floor for the majority of the listen, and I felt so inspired by her strength. Louise currently co-hosts the podcast He Said, She Said with her partner Ryan Libby and authored the book Lucky, detailing her long road towards recovery. She is an unstoppable force of nature and she joins me today. Thank you so much for joining me on Rise with Roxy.
Thanks for having me.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. I'm happy to be here. These chairs are super comfy.
I know. It's encouraging you to go deep.
Yeah.
And open up and yes. Create a safe space.
Yeah, it's a really good environment for that. And I feel good. I just got back from a trip away with my family.
Yeah.
Yeah, which felt like it was really needed. So I went away with Leo and Ryan, and then we actually took away his parents and my mum, which is mm-hmm. the first time we've ever done something like that.
Oh, wow.
Like blending the parents.
How was it?
It was good. It was really nice.
Yes.
Yeah. It felt like a good thing to be able to do to, you know, we've been working really hard for the last couple of years, but especially the last 6 months. So to have a break and then to feel like we were working towards something to be able to treat them.
Aww.
It was almost like a role reversal. Like we were the parents and so we were like, no, don't worry guys, we've got it covered.
Aww.
Like you follow our agenda.
Sometimes it's a bit like you've got to remember what it's for, like what you're doing it for.
Exactly.
You know, it's for experiences like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't go away enough. Like the last time I went away with Leo was January 24, overseas. So not been on a flight with him in nearly 2 years.
I bet he loved it.
Yeah, he really did. He had a 5-to-1 adult to child ratio. So it was sort of the dream.
Oh my gosh.
I know there'll be a lot of people listening on that will be very envious of that.
Yes. Yes. Louise, firstly, we have known each other for so many years. I think at least 20 years, I reckon. We're probably about seven. No. How old am I? No, I would say about 17, 18 years we've known each other, which is crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
It is wild. Over the last few years, you know, I've been closely watching your journey and I am so excited to kind of like dive into your story because, you know, this podcast is about rising, right? It's about rising up, rising again and rising above. Mm. And you are kind of like the epitome of someone who has risen over and over again. And so for me, I'm just so honored to have you here and for you to share what I think is such an incredible story with the people listening.
Thank you.
So thank you.
What an introduction. You're so kind. Honestly, thank you. That means a lot to me.
Let's start with before you joined Made in Chelsea. What were you like then?
So I have always been such a goody two shoes. Like, I've always been a rule follower, always done everything by the book. I think, like, even since I was a child, my mom would always say I was an angel child and then a devil teenager. I suppose the thing that was a little unusual was the fact that I did get shipped off to an all-girls boarding school at 11. My brother went to boarding school when he was just 8, and I remember him being really upset by that.
How do you feel about it looking back on it?
At the time, I didn't overthink it. It was, we were at a school and probably 50, 60, 70% of the girls in my year went to a girls' boarding school. Mm-hmm. So it was an all-girls prep school as well. So I had very little interaction with men and or boys. I don't judge my parents for it at all. And actually then I was very grateful for the decision because I've had an amazing education. And that's really the privilege I think that going to a fee-paying school offers you is the people that you're surrounded with, or, you know, and obviously the education and the attention. But yeah, so I had a lot of attention and I was basically told what to do. And I was so good at being told what to do. And as long as I followed the instructions, everything was good. Mm. But then the moment that I hit around 15, things got pretty messy. I think it was alcohol, because when I was at school, I wasn't allowed to drink and I was fine when I was at school. And then it was only when I was at home on the weekends and I started drinking that my behavior was erratic and I could be quite like impulsive and probably quite either everybody's, typically everybody's best friend, but I think looking at the sort of family dynamic, I was not particularly nice to my family. They got like the raw end of the deal. And that was, it was only really challenging to me at the time when I was dealing with the consequences of excessive drinking. So I loved it in the time and I never really complained about it. But then when I would feel really ill afterwards and deal with horrendous hangovers or come down or having to retrace my steps and apologizing to people, and I had very little money because I didn't have a proper job and I'd lose a lot of stuff. I couldn't get phone insurance anymore.
Yeah.
It was typical like destructive behavior. And it was at a similar time then when I got sort of exposed to some boys for the first time and I got very overexcited. Maybe by the attention, I don't know. And I then had back-to-back boyfriends for a long time. Many of whom you'll probably know, but literally there was just a series from the age of about 15. And I actually did get cheated on in near enough all of my relationships. So that was pretty damaging to the ego.
Very.
And then I spiraled.
Before Made in Chelsea, there had been this spiraling already?
Yeah.
With alcohol, boys.
And men. And the plan was to go away for a year around the world. And I'd met a guy before I went who ended up being on Made in Chelsea. And I cut my trip short basically for him. And that was just before I then went to university. And I suppose he was one of the reasons why I ended up on Made in Chelsea. I was part of a sort of a group that were in it right at the beginning. And when the show started, I didn't want to be in it at all.
Like,
I
just, oh, you didn't?
No.
Why?
No. I'd been actually quite snobby about it.
Right.
I think because most of my friends, we didn't know anything about reality TV at the time. It was still a relatively new phenomenon. I thought, no, I'm going to get I've had a really good education, so I'm going to get a good degree and I'm going to have a really serious career. And I'm going to end up in the city.
Yeah.
And I had my arm twisted. I would be up and down from Edinburgh to London like a yo-yo. And I remember actually my first scene, I had to hide in a coffee shop. And I had to walk into an art gallery and Frances Bull was there and Rosie and their faces, I think they were just really shocked. And so then I felt like a bit of an idiot. And I had very little confidence still at that point. And it was hard.
Yeah.
But I got into it.
There wasn't an expectation that this show about you know, not in a mean posh people in London would do well, right? Like who's like there wasn't that was what it felt like, right? But it flew. Were you expecting that at all? And how did you actually feel about its success?
I know I had no expectations. I had no plans. And I definitely didn't have the foresight to think, oh, I'm going to be in a great position in 5 years' time when I can leverage all of this sort of popularity to then work with brands on big advertising campaigns. I was just sort of winging it day to day. And then it felt odd going back to university where I spent the majority of the time either, you know, in my flat or then going out or in the library, which is where everybody worked. And people then started to watch the show. And I'd walk around and it felt a bit uncomfortable that people knew my business and that people would be judging me. And I didn't know what to do with myself. So that was a little odd.
What do you think that did for you? Because it sounds like at this time of your life, given what you've said about men and, you know, even like cutting your trip short because there was someone you liked, you know, that for me perhaps speaks of someone that is seeking validation elsewhere, right? That doesn't have that like internal foundation of self-worth, which I think is so normal for most young women. What did that do to your sense of self?
I really sought validation externally from external factors. And I was really vulnerable then to the comments that people would make, especially, being someone, a girl in their early 20s who just wanted to be loved.
So what were your coping mechanisms then?
Drinking. And that's really, this is a therapy session, Roxy. This is so useful.
Good.
But it was, it actually just then propelled me further into the like cyclone of doom. I never spoke to anyone about it. I didn't speak to my friends that I lived with about it. I didn't speak to my parents. I definitely didn't speak to my parents about it. And I definitely didn't speak to the producers about it. There wasn't any support at that time, kind of in the mental health space within the team that we were working with. And so I remember one day actually I was walking up the hill in Edinburgh, walking towards the library, and I started to dissociate. And that was the first time that had ever happened to me. I felt really disconnected from my body.
And what do you mean by that? Describe it to someone who's got no idea.
For me, I felt like I was sort of up there above me, looking down on me. And I could look at other people that I was walking past, and they all felt like they were in a different game, like the game of life. Like they were on that side and I was on this side. And I'd look at them and think, why can't I be normal like them? Like, I'm really detached right now from reality. So it was really scary. And it didn't happen actually again, I don't think. But I did immediately like call a doctor in Edinburgh and asked for an appointment. And then they prescribed me some mental health medication, which actually I never took.
Right.
But I had it in my drawer.
Yeah.
In my little flat. So that was a kind of a backup tool. And the only other thing was surrounding myself with other people who were going through a hard time and drinking our way through it.
And because what was the drinking culture like at that point? I think there's a very fine line between having fun and having a problem. And I think when you're that age and there's always someone doing it worse than you or drinking more than you, it can be very hard to see where on that line you sit. What was your experience with that?
So yeah, there was a huge binge drinking culture. I just attracted all of the people that were going through the same thing as me. And I think that really happened like week one of being at university. Like we had, even just walking through the corridors and the halls that I was in, I could spot these people. Oh yeah, you look like you've got the same problems as me. Let's us hang out. Let's all sit in our dorm on our bed. And it wasn't a dormitory, but the same sort of thing. And and just drink and then go out. And also there was almost like a sort of badge of honor for who could get the most drunk and who mm-hmm. could come up with the most silly stories. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where actually one of my really good friends, who won't mind me saying this, but things got so bad for her that she ended up having to leave for a year to go to rehab. Mm. And I was definitely kind of facing that trajectory as well. Mm. I made a lot of mistakes during that time.
Like what?
Well, I blew up like a lot of the relationships that I was in. I was very selfish and very juvenile.
You've said that Ryan sort of helped you change your relationship to alcohol. What was it that he had done that helped you?
Ryan was super healthy when I met him. He was a PT, and he has always prioritized his own like mental and physical health. And I really respect that. Mm. He taught me how to do that. He basically taught me how to love myself. And I think there were a few times actually early on in the relationship. I went out and I was hungover and I ended up back at I would go to his flat the following day just to hang out. Mm. And he'd look at me in a different way. And he was just really unattracted by that whole look, like the smell, the mess, the stories. He wasn't impressed by it like other people that I'd been with. And I realized that I needed to just stop. Mm. And then when I did sort of stop, he was also the first person actually that I felt truly confident around. Mm. In his company, I think it felt there were no external voices. We weren't at uni or at school where everybody was involved. Mm-hmm. It was just me and him. So I felt as though I could just be with him without needing the confidence from the drinking. Mm-hmm. And that felt amazing. And we started exercising a lot together, which obviously everyone knows feels amazing.
Yeah.
And then there was this sort of just the compound effect of all the good stuff that happened mm-hmm. as a result of living well and being really healthy. You know, physically, like I looked better. Mentally, I felt clearer.
This kind of starts a whole new chapter of your life, really, because you discover fitness and that kind of opened up a lot of doors for you, right? Outside of Made in Chelsea. So what kind of happens in the next few years?
I guess the whole fitness thing was brilliant because I finally felt really, really passionate about something. Mm. So I felt as though I had a bit of a purpose. There was this big shift in my life that came from cutting out a lot of bad habits and working on myself. So I felt good. I had confidence. And then also I had the motivation of other people being like, oh, wow, that's really like really cool what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed sharing a lot more about what I was doing on social media platforms and on Instagram and grew a following quite quickly. And I did a couple of covers for Women's Health and there were a lot of brilliant things. And I do think, you know, I don't talk about manifesting very much. I know that's very much your bag. I do think that I sort of started really attracting all of those things in. I've never really taken the chance publicly actually to say thank you to Ryan, but I am really grateful to him for all of that because I honestly, like, I couldn't have done it without him. And I, you know, I probably would be in a really dark spot if I hadn't met him. Mm. And that's really beautiful. And I was sort of taking all of the glory and he was the person that was really kind of propping me up and putting me on this pedestal.
Aww.
Yeah, everyone needs a ride.
Yeah, they do. That's really beautiful. Mm. That really is special.
I love him a lot.
And at what point and what was your pregnancy journey with Ryan? Was that something that you guys had spoken about and planned, or?
It was during lockdown, so 2020. A lot of my friends started having kids. And I started to feel like it was a good time. I really doubt I'm alone in thinking this, so I shouldn't feel too guilty about saying it. But I liked the idea of having a child that could play with my friends' kids. But yeah, we tried to get pregnant, or I tried to get pregnant, and we did actually get pregnant, and then we had a miscarriage, an early one. Mm-hmm. And it was actually at that moment that I knew that Ryan would be a really good dad, and also that he was on board with the whole thing because he was really upset by it. Mm. And so if we sort of had the... We had a kind of a moment, a special moment grieving over that loss. And then we were like, okay, well, let's at least now we really know.
Yeah.
It's one good thing to have come from it. We were fairly lucky. We got pregnant again a few months later. It was a funny odd time because we were doing this renovation, which is fairly cliche, and moved to my mum's house, and that was quite a big change to live with a parent again after so many years.
So you move into your mum's.
Yeah.
And how was it?
I'm not very good at living with people.
Mm.
I was back at school, but I'd reached a place where I was like in a really nice routine with living at home. My brother lived next door. Life was good. And so then having that shift felt quite hard. If you live in someone else's home, you kind of always feel like you're on their territory, or mm-hmm. you're on their turf.
Yeah.
And I think pregnancy after miscarriage is always quite hard. It's not the same as pregnancy without miscarriage.
Right.
And so I was slightly, I was analyzing things quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I was just really like keeping stock of everything, messaging myself little notes, which I didn't realize was weird at the time, but I was tracking a lot.
Right.
I was trying to take control over the pregnancy as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was okay. Ryan and I we kind of grew kind of disconnected.
Through the pregnancy,
how especially come? From sort of the middle to the end. I don't know whether it's a small person thing. I was really heavy when I was pregnant, and I felt as though there was just no room to carry this baby. So I felt particularly unattractive. And also with my identity being focused around the whole fitness thing,
mm-hmm.
having gone from working out every single day and feeling really good. I mean, I mm-hmm. felt so well.
Mm.
I could have long days. I'd wake up at 5, I'd go to bed at 10, 11, and I was just full of energy.
Mm-hmm.
That energy was depleted so quickly. And I couldn't jump anymore. I used to jump and do loads of cardio, and I just couldn't move. And so I felt like I was quite disconnected from Ryan, who I'd forged a big kind of fitness relationship with, but also from the community that we'd built up. We had this whole fitness business. I couldn't really host in the same way that I wanted to do that. And
so there was this kind of, you'd kind of pinned what you called like an almost like an identity on health and wellness before, and now that's stripped away. Were you surprised that that impacted your relationship with Ryan in that way?
Yeah, I think it definitely came as a surprise. I never could have imagined it. It took a chunk out of our relationship, and then we weren't intimate at all. I didn't mm-hmm. want to be intimate with him. I don't think he really wants to be intimate with me in that third trimester. And I didn't overthink it at the time, but I mm-hmm. think that probably fed into some of me not feeling so good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've never questioned Ryan's morals in our relationship before. I've never questioned his loyalty before.
Mm-hmm.
But I did think that he would start to look at women that weren't pregnant mm-hmm. more than he would look at me.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bit hard.
Yeah.
And so I started actually throwing myself into work a lot.
Right.
Towards the end of the pregnancy. Yeah. That was then a thing that I could be addicted to because I wasn't going to do the drinking.
And then I remember in your book, you then talked about the fire that happened.
Mm.
And I think because of everything that follows, which was so, like, of course, we'll go into that, that I almost got the sense when I was following your story that the fire gets completely forgotten, whereas that on its own is a very significant event. Could you, if you're comfortable, and this goes for everything, and I said this before the show, but anything, I will ask the questions, but feel free not to answer anything that doesn't feel right for you today. Could you talk us through what happened with the fire?
Do you know what's really strange about this whole fire thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really said this, but I feel as though I feel like a lot of negative things happened really quickly. And I feel like there was something that was going on. Mm. I was being thrown these challenges to see whether I could overcome challenges from the past, to see whether I could stand up and make the right decision. Mm. What was crazy about the evening of the fire was that day I had, for the first time ever, looked at Ryan's phone, and I was looking for something, and I found something that I didn't like. It was not that incriminating, otherwise I wouldn't be saying it on this podcast mm-hmm. without getting his permission. And so it's not as though I'm sort of doing that, but it was a problem for where we were at in our relationship. And I remember seeing it and and it triggered me immensely because of everything that I'd been through in the past. I knew I needed to just get out of the house because I couldn't compose myself and I couldn't think about what I wanted to say in that scenario. Mm. So I left the house and I ran away to ours where we were doing this building. It was a building site, so we were doing the renovation. And I just sat on the stairs and I cried on my own because there were no builders there. And then Ryan came round and I did have a bit of a light bulb moment where I went, okay, this can either go one of two ways. And so I decided to go down this pathway, the good one. Mm. And we had a bit of a conversation about it, as measured as we could, because I was obviously very upset. And then we went home that day, and later that night, then this fire happened. And we were sleeping in separate bedrooms, and we'd never slept in separate bedrooms at my mom's house. So he was in the basement and I was sleeping upstairs. I think it was like midnight or maybe 11, but I was well asleep by that point, complete granny, always in bed early. Mm. The fire alarm went off. And I just had assumed, I was woken up like in a bit of a frenzy thinking, God, what's that loud noise? I thought, it's good, it's a false alarm, because I'd only ever known false alarms before. Yeah. And then within seconds, I knew, oh my goodness, we're in danger. This is a real fire. Because the whole house started filling with this intoxicating smoke so badly, to the point that then when I left the room, I mean, I was in pants and a t-shirt, and I opened the door and I saw all of the smoke coming up the stairs, and I actually have goosebumps even thinking about it now. All I could do was scream. I was like, oh my God, there's a fire. What's going on? What's happening? My mom started running from downstairs. I came downstairs. I actually selfishly ran out the front, but I was really, really, really worried at this point about the baby in my stomach, in my tummy. And so I ran out of the house screaming, not thinking about what to do next, just thinking, I need to survive and I need to make sure that I don't go into labor and that my baby's not going to get carbon monoxide poisoning and that this isn't going to jeopardize his life. Mm-hmm. My mum came out. Ryan had been in the basement, which actually is where the fire was. I was in a free state. Mm-hmm. And Ryan, bless him, then ran back in, and the dogs, they were actually sleeping in cages, big ones, nice ones, but because we were staying at my mum's, it was just more convenient, and he'd opened them and one of them basically ran away, so got lost in the fire. So he then had to run in and retrieve them, and then he thought it would be safer to go into the garden because that was just the quickest exit he could get to, and which it isn't, because then if the fire spreads, he would then have to find a way of jumping out and jumping into a neighbor's garden. But also with the dogs, that would be really challenging.
Right.
So between the three of us, we had to basically get everybody out the front. But what was crazy?
And what is the fire doing at this point? Because I can't even imagine.
Right. So it's all smoke.
Right.
So the fire, the flames and everything are in the basement, and the ground floor is where we exited through the front door. But it's the smoke that kills, because you can't breathe and you can't see. And so you're feeling to get out. And that was petrifying. And we were screaming so loudly outside the front of the house that all of the neighbors came out. Mm-hmm. And so everyone called 999, and then the ambulance came. And luckily, we actually live really close to the fire station and also incidentally the hospital. Mm. And they came really quickly and they went in. And that was all actually very just not a blur. I went into shock then after I'd gone from this freeze moment to then I was like convulsing a lot. My whole body was just in total shock. And it was also really cold. So I think it was around October. So it's cold in London. Ryan came in and put me in the car because I didn't have many clothes on either. But I couldn't stop shaking. And I was so worried then that I was going to go into labor or that something bad was happening. I mean, the cortisol was just coursing throughout my body and I couldn't slow it down through breathing, through anything. So we ended up going to the hospital in an ambulance, came to collect us and ran some checks. And I was monitored and they did, all of the tests for the sort of poisoning. Mm. And we were okay after being in the hospital for several hours.
Mm.
But then we had this thing of going, well, I don't know where to go. Yeah, the next thing then, we're being discharged from hospital and we're trying to find a place to stay. And then we kind of stay in a series of quite strange hotels in Fulham.
Right.
Because we don't have anywhere else to go.
For how long?
For, I think it was 10 days. So then my dad, who has a flat in London, but he spends most of his time elsewhere. He basically, and it's actually just a two bed, but it's more like a 1.5 bed flat. He said, well, you'll have to move in there and this is going to have to be your home then for up until like you have the baby and afterwards.
Yeah.
And so we did that. I remember people really stepping in, like, you know, the CEO of Insanity, the agency I'm with, people that I worked with. People were very kind. A lot of people reached out to me. They couldn't believe it. The only thing good to have come from that, I thought, was, okay, everyone make sure, I was then telling everybody to make sure that they had smoke alarms and fire alarms installed in their house, because that really did save our life. If we hadn't woken up, then I don't know what we would have done.
Yeah.
But it was really traumatic because I was scared.
Mm.
And I didn't know what that was going to do to my health, my unborn child's health. I just felt like there was like a whole road of unknown ahead of me.
Mm.
This path, I just didn't know what that looked like at all.
Mm.
And then it got worse because I then had my whole sort of childbirth experience, which happened only a couple of weeks afterwards. In that interim period, it was really difficult for me because I knew I wasn't in a great spot. And I knew at the back of my head that I really needed to have a C-section.
Mm.
I knew my body, I know my hips, my pelvis. And also I know my mind and my brain and what I was capable of, especially in that anxious state. And I knew that I needed to have some control over at least the delivery of my son. And I kept having these conversations and I kept meeting roadblocks and I was made to jump through hurdle and push to somebody else. No, have a conversation with this person. And I never really got to have a conversation with a consultant obstetrician who gave me the option to choose whether to have a C-section or not.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I was pushed to have home births because I was low risk. And in the end, I just resigned to my fate and I thought, okay, well, it's too last minute now. So I really thought I was making an educated decision.
Mm.
And I couldn't do it. They didn't have space for me. No one offered me an appointment.
Mm.
So then I went into labor and I went to our local hospital, which obviously had changed because we weren't living where the hospital was the same, but you know, the drive, the mental state, like everything about it, the experience had changed because of the fire. And a lot of bad things happened to me. It was a weekend and they like notoriously didn't know it back then, but there's skeleton staffing on the weekend. So they just don't have the same capacity that they do midweek. I remember thinking that that was a good thing because the car park would be empty. There's less people in the hospital on the weekend, but it's not the case. We came in and really quickly I went from here to here in terms of the pain. And I was so poorly educated on the whole thing, but I was put in a side room or a birthing room, and we were left in there with no attention, to the point where then this lady who had checked us in, she was clocking off for her shift around eight. It's always like 8 to 8. They work 12 hours, which is incredibly hard. And she came in and went, oh my God, why is no one doing anything with this girl? I was literally lying on the floor screaming in just a heap of pain. She was like, get this girl bent over here. There's a ball here. Get a towel, rinse it in some hot water, cold water, put it on her neck. Has anyone even asked whether she'd like some gas or air? Has anyone given her any options? No one had given me any options. I was just saying, I need some pain relief. And there was nothing. It was just like cold, dark, empty. And then she had to go. She had to go home. And so I had this really long labor where eventually I did ask for an epidural really early on. And they couldn't get it in. No one that was there could get it in. So they tried several different people, and then well beyond the 2 hour point, they managed to get it in. So I sort of landlocked on this bed, and the pain was still there. I had a really bad temperature. I was basically infected and had meconium in my waters, which they'd broken, but no one escalated. So I think also there was this sort of silent, slight escalation, because since I've read Cerner notes, I've read lots of detailed reporting, but people, and I think this is one of the things I'm really advocating about at the moment to change, is that midwives, obstetricians, doctors, whoever is involved in that birth process, that they need to communicate what is going on with the patient so that they have an understanding of what is going on in the room and to their body. And that just doesn't happen.
Were you in a panic state at this point? Did you kind of know something was going wrong?
Yeah, I was really panicked. And I also think that the gas and air was not good for me. So I felt as though I was having an out-of-body experience, sort of hallucinating. I kept saying to anyone that would come in the room, like, we need to move to the next phase, which is going to be a C-section. Like, that is the only way that my child is going to come out of me, because I knew instinctively that he wasn't going to come out. But also I was having this awful thing where when I would talk, I'd hear my voice played back, and people were looking at me just like, it's fine. And I was like, it's not fine. It's really not fine. It wasn't fine. And then it was only when there was a change of staff the following morning, on the Monday, I suppose, when everyone comes into work, that they came in and they went, yeah, there's no way that this child is coming out of you. He's really distressed now. I'm in a really bad way. Like, I'd been stuck at, I think, like 7-8 centimeters dilated for a really, really long period of time. There had been irregularities in the heartbeat, and they finally needed to take me to theatre. And I'd been like begging for the kind of many, many hours before that. But I don't know who was there. And I think I will get some peace of mind if I can just get an answer as to like who was there that night. I think there was a major surgery happening. So some people couldn't come and see me. And there were just two junior doctors who would come in whenever we would say we needed some more help. And they would just, I could see like a bit of some fear in their face, that their role was just to keep me quiet. Just, no, keep going, you're fine. And then they would go back out. But there was no advice. There was really kind of no support. And so yeah, moved to have the C-section, which I was incredibly excited about, because I was like completely at the end of it, like the end of the road. Like, I can't go on much longer in this state. And I went into the theatre, and it was so bad. I'm quite a smart person. And I did know, I say like I was not educated enough about this whole thing. I thought that a C-section was supposed to be 20 minutes, half an hour, maybe 40 minutes. But I was lying on that table for near to 3 hours, watching myself be operated on with a huge amount of blood loss. So 3/4 of the volume of the blood in my body. I could see it everywhere. It was all over the floor. It was all over the screen. And I really believed that I was going to die. And the only thing I could say to anybody was Ryan. And I just kept saying, am I alive? Because I thought that it was all over and that I was just watching this happen to me. And I could also see fear in his face, and I could feel a lot of like rattling with a lot of instruments and also a lot of pressure right up by my lungs. A lot of pressure to try and stop the bleeding, a lot of alarm bells going off. And again, no communication to me as to what was going on or that things were going to be okay. And they had to call in other people to help stem the bleeding. And essentially they'd cut because he'd got progressed and gone quite far down. He was stuck in my pelvis. They had to use something called a pillow to push him back up in. But I mean, a pillow, it's not actually a pillow. And then like my uterus basically like snapped the whole way around. So it ripped and the bleeding was really excessive and they just couldn't stop the bleeding. It's so visceral to me because it's the memories are like something I've been traumatized with or by for the last 3.5 years. But I really thought I was dead. And then the aftercare was not great. I was put in a side room. I should have been in a high dependency unit since I've learned that there wasn't enough space apparently in the high dependency unit, which is not good enough. And so I had a CT scan because of the pain that I was in, and someone came in. They couldn't, unfortunately, it was a weekend again. And someone said, sorry, there's no one around to read the CT scan. And they sent me home. And then 2 days later, I had a massive obstetric hemorrhage at home.
Like, is it just kind of a story? Because are you going back to the flat?
It basically wasn't ready for us to move in. So there'd been this mad panic to try and get the house finished. And we were staying in just a room, like a spare room, if you like, with a bed, but there wasn't any furniture. So we didn't have like a bedroom and there was no like table or chairs or sofas.
Right.
And there was sort of dust cloths over everything. But we did, Ryan's mum, bless her, and my mum had gone round to try and get like some plates and a few like provisions and stuff there. And I just remember like crying and crying and crying and crying and thinking, oh, okay, that was hell, but maybe things are going to be okay. And then walking through the front door, and I literally like collapsed on the floor in tears because I just was so overwhelmed by my life. Honestly, I was like, I don't know, what's just happened, honestly. And I couldn't really move either. And so I had to be carried up the stairs. And then I was just in this bedroom for a few days and just family came in. And I do have some pictures. And I look very unwell. Like I'm incredibly white. Everything is really, really swollen. Mm-hmm. And I was just lying there and no one had really explained what had happened to me. I just tried to put on a smiley face because I knew that I had this baby and that was the done thing. So I was acting like a robot.
Yeah. So you go home, you do the things that you're supposed to do when you have a baby. Then what happens?
So when I was in the hospital, they were really encouraging me to breastfeed. That was actually one of the things that was really amplifying the pain down here on the lower left side. And they were very pushy with the breastfeeding. And that was really hard when my baby was covered in tubes. And also I was really incapacitated. I'd get an excruciating pain down there. And I know that breastfeeding now causes the oxytocin to flood your body and then it helps your uterus contract down. But if they'd listened to me about the pain, then they would have known that actually there was a problem with the uterus every time that I was breastfeeding and that was a signal. And then when I was at home, it was bottle feeding. But actually, and I've never said this publicly, but I decided at one point that I was going to breastfeed. Mm. And I was in this room on my own and I thought, oh, well, I'll just try and put him on my boob and see what happens. And that happened, and then put him down. And then, must have been within the next hour, out of nowhere, I literally start bleeding, like really, really heavily. It was just nonstop blood pouring out, and I screamed, and Ryan then came running into the room. and started putting towels underneath me. And we were filling up numerous towels with a lot of blood. Just, there was blood everywhere. And so he had to call 999 immediately. And they were saying that they were going to take 10 minutes. And luckily, they then literally did come in 2 minutes because it was late at night and I only live a couple of minutes away from the hospital. And my again, you know, in this state of crisis, you don't know what to do. Like logistically, Ryan called my mum and my mum came around. Luckily, she lives around the corner and she was carrying Leo, the baby, who, and I say it like that, which sounds awful, but at the time, he didn't have a name to me. He was just a baby. Mm-hmm. And that this whole thing had kind of happened and it was related to him. And yeah, she was stood there on the landing with this baby as I was basically carted down the stairs on this chair. And I'm looking into their eyes, like begging, like, please, can you do something? I think one of the devastating things was that Ryan wasn't able to come through with me. And no, there was such a feeling of slowness that I couldn't get my head around, because my whole life is whizzing through my mind a million miles an hour. I'm remembering everything. Like every single memory is just like flooding my brain. And yet everyone is so cool and calm. The hardest thing about that period of time, again, was the lack of communication and the fact that there were moments where I was in that room on my own. I'm not able to think straight either. Mm. And then there was a point where someone came in and they had a form and they said, you're going to need to sign this form. And I just remember begging, saying, put me to sleep, like just put me to sleep. And I suppose probably because I'd had the experience before where I'd been awake for 3 hours, that was torture in itself. And the experience that I was having, you know, in that moment where I was, it was a mental pain. So even though I was bleeding loads, and there was all that physical stuff going on inside me, it felt like that physical pain was actually transported to my brain. And it's something that I still have flashbacks about. It's honestly the worst flashbacks I've had since in recovery have been me shouting, I need to go back to the hospital and be put to sleep. And they did put me to sleep. And that was the best thing that they could have ever done. And I was so, so grateful, because then I didn't have to experience what happened. And I woke up in intensive care with tubes down my throat. And that was really very scary because I couldn't talk. I didn't know where I was. And no one was in the room when I woke up. And
this is really the thing of nightmares.
It's the thing of nightmares. It was just awful, Roxy. I lost trust in everything around me. So the people that would come in to administer the medication, because there's a lot of monitoring. So you're like regular blood tests. Obviously like lots of tubes, they're giving, you know, whether it's like electrolytes, magnesium, like things going in from drips. At certain points, just being in that state of high alert, I thought that person's in here to kill me. Like I actually felt like I was in one of those horror movies. Mm. I thought, well, I've lost trust in this whole system given what I've been through before. Mm. Like, how can I trust you now to make my life better and to heal me without having someone in here that I know that I do trust because I have some previous trusting experience with them,
yeah,
like a family member. And yeah, I was in the hospital for a few weeks after that, I think 3 weeks. Without knowing, again, no one came in to tell me, like, this is what has happened and this is the reason why, unlike other surgeries.
So at this point, you really have no idea.
No, I don't know what they've done in the theatre either. So I guess if you go in, and this is the difference, I think, between like a planned hospital experience versus an emergency one, is I've had other subsequent emergency surgeries, but I've known what's going to happen and what the outcome might look like and what to expect when I wake up. Mm-hmm. But with this, there's none of that. So it's really alarming. And even from the kind of psyche point of view, the mental health point of view, when it comes to recovery, your brain is always going to think the worst in that state. Mm. And if no one's there to map out what's happened to you, you're going to connect the dots, but you're literally going to create like a really, really dark picture. And then it's like connecting the dots blind. You're literally like, I don't know whether they've removed a kidney. I don't know whether I thought that my voice, they'd remove my voice box because of the tubes in there, being in there and me not being able to talk. I didn't know. I had no idea what they'd done inside me. I didn't know where the bleeding was coming from, whether it was another organ, whether it was the, like they'd nicked like arteries. I mean, I didn't know a lot.
And for these 3 weeks, is Ryan coming to see you every day? Is he bringing Leo? What's happening at this time?
You're not allowed children in intensive care because they can bring in an infection.
Right.
And people up there tend to be very sick. So when I moved down to the high dependency unit, Ryan was allowed to bring in Leo, and he would bring him in. And I had no idea how hard that was for him, even just juggling the parenting at home. Mm-hmm. I'm with his mum sometimes, but then often on his own, then driving in with this baby that he'd not formed a relationship with yet to tend to this kind of emergency mm-hmm. recovery. And really, like, it took us again a few years to feel comfortable enough to look at some of the pictures of him, like, laying out like Inco sheets in the back of his car, changing Leo's nappy, and then like bringing him up to come and see me in the baby seat. And the baby seat then was just in the corner of the room. And I would never ask about Leo. I didn't even know that he was there. Mm. So someone might come in and then put him down. And then it was just all eyes on me and all eyes on what had happened and like, how have we let this happen? Mm. Who's in charge? Who can we speak to? But it was just this whole unknown haze. I think hospitals are a very unfamiliar place for a lot of people as well, mm. unless you're unfortunate enough to have had somebody that you know in your family who has been really unwell and to have visited regularly. As a first-time parent or mother, like, it can feel like Mars.
Yeah.
The visits were necessary from family, but I couldn't get out. I couldn't get into a normal headspace. I think there were a couple of times where I felt like I could talk about normal things. And I think that early on in my recovery, I kind of kept referring to myself as two people. So like old Louise and then new Louise. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to get back to old Louise. Old Louise was like a present person that was grounded, that can remember things from her past. New Louise was a traumatized baby who only knew the trauma and didn't know how to live in the world aside from that.
So quite quickly, when after you've woken up, you'd say like there was it almost an immediate shift mentally into this kind of new Louise state, or was it a gradual decline?
I only really noticed it when I then spent a bit more time around normality. I was like flicking between these two people, mm-hmm. and that I had like a few, and I call them, they were kind of like the glimmers of my old life and like the glimmers of hope, if you like, where I connected with something from the past. So it might be like my dad coming in and saying something silly and me like tapping into that side of my brain, mm-hmm. and for a sort of second or minute, I would have a moment of peace where I wasn't on high alert. And I guess actually that's really what the recovery was from a heavily traumatized person. It was trying to bring in more of those moments where I felt safe and connecting with my old life.
Once you go home, I think most people assume that when you leave hospital, that's kind of where recovery begins. Mm. But what I think I was most struck by in your posting was the decline in your mental health. But you have this amazing way of helping people understand what it's like to go through something that is so unimaginable. Mm. And I think for me, it is the physical recovery is one thing, but your journey of mental health for me is the most inspiring thing. And so could we go through that side of things? Once you get home, what happens to your mental health and how does it actually manifest itself?
It's very hard to quantify mental health. And what was really scary for me was that when I came back from the hospital where I thought I was going to be okay, so I could have some normal conversations with family members. And I tried, and I mentioned this in the book, but like I tried to book some like appointments, some sort of general like housekeeping, sort of opticians appointments and things that I thought I might need. I felt,
by the way,
no, but isn't that weird? So basically, it's so odd. Like I was in the hospital for maybe like a month, like in total with both visits. I felt like I'd been in there for my whole life. It's really odd. I felt like I'd been in there for 6 months and that I'd not lived a life at home, like ever. And so I was like, I need to do these checkups. I need a dentist appointment. Because I genuinely was like, all my teeth must be rotten. To be fair, I didn't really brush my teeth once. I didn't like wash my body. I actually hadn't washed. Like, it's disgusting, but I didn't wash for a month. I didn't brush my teeth. I definitely didn't go to the optician.
Look, I can't stand the dentistry. It's just the eye test.
The eye test is so bad. Because I really thought that like everything had just fallen apart and that like I was, and that because I'd had all this surgery that ergo I must be having deteriorating eye health and maybe going blind. I was so paranoid about everything. And it doesn't make logical sense. And the amazing thing is that I can sit here now and talk about all of the really awful stuff, get upset, have goosebumps, feel like I'm living it, but also then laugh about some of the things, which is, you know, the message that I want to give to the people out there that are listening who might be right in the trenches right now, to go, one day I might be able to laugh about some of this stuff, because it is really scary being on that spectrum, sitting anywhere within it. I won't diminish anything from anyone that feels like they are struggling with mental health, because a struggle is a struggle. Mm-hmm. But after about 5 days, I was walking down the road, and it might have been longer actually than 5 days, because I was really not doing stuff out and about. But an ambulance went past, and I like fully dissociated, and I, to the point where I was,
and
I
again,
don't know where
when
I
you
am.
Describe that dissociation, that's you having an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, an out-of-body experience, but a really scary out-of-body experience. So it's not just feeling disconnected and then having normal thoughts where I think, okay, like this is really horrible and this feels really alien, but I'm going to come back into my body in a bit because I know what it's like to be in my body. It's, oh my God, I'm going to be stuck like this forever. Everything then became a really, really, really scary thought. And that is a really weird place to live.
What do you mean by that? Sorry. No, I know it's so probably bad. Really hard to explain in words.
From the moment that I would wake up, my brain was going, it was sounding an alarm bell, like ding, 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 ding. Every single thing that I could see was a threat. So I'd look in the mirror and everything, whether it was like my tongue, there's something wrong with my tongue, my eyes, my anything like Ryan would say, he could say one word and I'd be like, he hates me, he's gonna kill me. I was surrounded by perpetual fear. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to get out of it. All logical thought goes out of your head. They're all illogical, irrational thoughts, but they're all just thoughts that are trying to keep you safe. I didn't know what was going on. So at this point, I didn't know what trauma was. I didn't know what post-traumatic stress disorder was. I didn't know what flashback was. So when I wasn't then in that like heavy flashback scenario where I felt like frozen and unable to tap into like a normal state of consciousness, I was then worried that it was going to happen again. So I was constantly just then worried about, it was the fear of the fear, and you end up like on a roundabout and you're trying to figure out which way is the exit, but you can't because your brain's not working. And so you're just going round and round and round and you're lost. And I was just living a life that was lost for such a long time. And I just don't even know how I got through it. Like, I really don't know how I'm here today, like living a normal life. Because I couldn't figure out the way to get off that path. So I had to really shut out like the world because I was just triggered by everything. And even the therapist that I work with, she called it analyzing thoughts, because even if the thought wasn't negative, I was waiting for the next thought. And I think that that is real mental unwellness.
I can't imagine also how this is as a new family. Like, you've also got like a new baby, and Ryan's never done that before. And it, like, how is he coping in this time? Is he coping?
We weren't really a family. I don't think we had a single nice kind of family moment. I wouldn't call it a family. I don't know what it was. It was three people, three babies that weren't really able to do anything for themselves or one another. We were not in a good spot because I was so like vegetated and out of it and in my own head.
In these days, are you like, is it quite literally you're just getting from minute to minute? Like, are you, just because I want to really like paint a picture of this time, yeah. Is it kind of that you're, there's no like normality in terms of like day-to-day functioning? Yeah. You're just passing time?
So we're passing time. That's exactly it. And we didn't have a routine. I think Ryan tried to have a routine with Leo, our son. I was only really holding him for like a minute at a time at that stage. But my routine was medical appointments. So that was the thing I was holding on to. Mm-hmm. So I had basically booked in, either I had NHS or private appointments every single day. And if I look, because actually there's like, you know, my calendar, if I look back, was just mental health appointments to get through to the next day. Right. And it was the crisis team, I guess, that they were the best ones to lend the support to bridge the gap until I could start thinking a bit more normally. Mm-hmm. So, and the main thing that they would do is, so they'd come for like an hour, 2 hours every day, always two people, safety for them in numbers because they're going into strangers' yeah. homes, to go sit around a table, to have a drink, like water, tea, to ask some questions, and basically to provide reassurance that things will get better. Mm. And so the one that was actually a real helpful thing for me was them being able to tell me that they'd seen people who'd been in a really messed up place that had made improvements.
Yeah.
So I clung on to that with everything that I had. And they told me the medication will kick in and you'll start to feel better.
Yeah.
But because I'd had a really unhealthy relationship with the medical trauma and the hospital, mm-hmm. I was pretty scared to take the mental health medication. Mm-hmm. And I'm someone as well, prior to all of this, who was, bar the contraception stuff, like never even really took paracetamol. Maybe right. like 10 paracetamol.
Really?
Yeah. I did take a little bit of medication for my inflammatory bowel disease.
Yes.
But even with that, it was, I always had taken like the lowest of what I could, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to, I'd always been like pretty good, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to want that, all that stuff.
And at this point, by the way, so how many months after the birth are you at this point?
So I take the mental health medication. Oh, so after the birth, this is probably like a month. And then within the first like 10 days from the communication, fine. It's okay, quickly you need
to be on the medication. So quite quickly you go to this point medication. Where the thoughts are looping.
Yeah.
So it's like a quite sudden decline.
Yeah.
And then the crisis management are there.
Yeah.
And then you start the medication.
So start the medication.
What's the kind of next step?
So medication-wise, it was probably within the first 2 weeks of me coming home mm-hmm. that I was prescribed something. It was quite hard because everything was prescribed remotely when I was having conversations with psychiatrists at the hospitals, that I was being diagnosed via Zoom. And it was the crisis team that then would bring me the prescription. They were really strict about me taking it and making sure. And I guess that's the thing about being unwell, is that you are sometimes not well enough to make you take your medication, or you've created a narrative in your head that the medication's going to kill you.
Yeah.
And you need to be reassured mm-hmm. that it's going to be the best thing for you.
What's the kind of next year like for you? Is there a kind of slow recovery with your mental health, or is it very forward, back?
That's the frustrating thing is that with the recovery, it's always like a couple of steps forward and then a giant leap back. Mm-hmm. So I often felt like I was moving backwards, especially for the first 4 to 5 months, because I think I was still experiencing new things within this post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of lying on the sofa and then tracking how I was feeling and having a medical appointment. And then at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, like I tended to have this moment where it would feel like time was all really warped. Mm. Like I'd have a chunk of time between like 3 and 5 where I didn't know what was happening. Mm. Like I'd kind of, it was almost like I really was going like in and out of consciousness. And then I'd like check a clock and I'd be like, oh my God, it's 6 o'clock. And I'd kind of like wake up.
Yeah. It must have been incredibly lonely.
It's very lonely. I used to cry a lot. I remember waking up because one of my best friends had her daughter at the same hospital exactly 2 months after I had Leo. I knew that she was going to be doing things, like normal things, like introducing friends to the baby, going for pram, pushes, walks in the park, baby classes. And I was still stuck at home
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't do anything.
Mm.
I didn't want to do anything because I didn't have the courage or the strength to do anything.
Yeah.
But I knew that old Louise wanted to do those things. But I was like mourning the loss of my old life. It felt like that person had died.
Yeah.
So it was very, very lonely. But I couldn't have had people overwhelming my space at that time.
No.
The kind of closest I got was I'd sit in the garden quite often, even in the cold, because it was the winter. And I later learned that the places that I would sit were the garden or the living room. Mm. And that those were the spaces that were the same as before pre-renovation. So right. My brain found a bit of comfort in those rooms.
Right.
I didn't want to go inside. I didn't really want to be around Leo or any crying or any stress. I honestly did a lot of just counting birds in the sky, which is really odd to think about because now I live a life that is so fast-paced again. Yeah. Where I don't look at the birds in the sky enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have my moments where I do. I then met with an amazing psychotherapist who works with people at the Maudsley Hospital, which is mm-hmm. for people that are very mentally unwell. And you talk through your experience and you find a safe place as well. So you work to find a safe place. And as you work through the really scary experiences, you kind of go through them in quite a lot of detail, going through all of the senses and all the feelings at the time. And then you move your eyes. There are a few different ways you can do it, but I was doing it remotely, so it was weird. I'd have to do it with a computer screen and put dots on the top corners, and I'd move my eyes from left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And like again, you know, this whole area of PTSD is still relatively poorly understood, but
mm-hmm.
It's supposed to help process trauma from, I think it's kind of, a lot of the memories get stuck in your brain and it's supposed to provide a feeling of safety. And for me, I was doing a lot of tapping as well.
Left, journaling.
Right, left, right, and a lot of journaling.
Mm-hmm.
Journaling actually was the kind of one thing, that was the only thing I could do.
Mm.
The writing. So it felt like I was really nonverbal for a lot of the time at the beginning, but I could write what was going on in my head and try to make sense of it that way.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that experience taught you about life?
I really think that anything is possible now because I never thought that I would be able to find my way out of this crisis, and I have. And so moving forward in life, I think I'm a bit riskier. I see what's next. I'm much less afraid of challenges that come my way. And I really do welcome them almost with open arms, especially the moderate ones that are less scary than this. Because I think I know I can overcome any of that. to be able to connect with so many people on something so deep. My conversation is so much more interesting and enriching. Mm. My relationship with my partner is a lot better. And I think nothing will ever phase us in the way that this has. Mm. So I really think that we've got a really long relationship ahead of us. But in the same way, like if something crazy does happen, and for whatever reason, we don't end up together in 20 years' time, I'm not afraid of that anymore. Mm. I'm not really afraid of much.
Do you think because you have realized how strong you are? I mean, for me, when I hear your story, I'm like, you were pushed to the edge of what any person can take, physically and mentally. I don't think people can ever understand what it feels like to be losing your mind, to mm. feel like you are out of control of your mind. I mean, that is terrifying. And to be pushed to such a terrifying and dark place, and to find the strength somewhere, somehow, to just keep going, for me is a remarkable thing. And that is what I find so deeply inspiring about you. Like, you, that must have taken every ounce of like energy to just keep going and not give up. And I think it's so, so incredible.
Thank you, my love. It really, I do feel very, very strong. I think what trauma teaches you is like just a much wider spectrum of life. In every avenue of what you do, like you've been to the depths, but also then you see these amazing heights because you've got the comparison. So when you do feel good, you feel amazing. The moments that I didn't have all those really heavy intrusive thoughts whirring around my head, when I had a break from them, I was like, this is what utter joy is, to not feel thoughts. I feel like I've just been given like so many keys where I can now just like unlock doors. And so from being someone that used to be so conscious about what people used to think and always trying to be perfect and a people pleaser, to then kind of feel so liberated is really, it is a blessing. It's people will all go through something traumatic at some stage in their life. And I used to feel really unlucky for going through something so significant at such a young age. But really, it just means that now I can accelerate throughout the rest of my life, which is cool.
I love that. And tell me about Leo. My God, he is so gorgeous.
He's so gorgeous, man.
He's so fucking cute.
He's so fucking cute, but so is your boy as well.
How has legends. Your journey with motherhood been over the last couple of years?
From really awful and non-existent. I know there will be other people that relate to this. Like, the bond is not always there. You know, lots of women struggle with postnatal depression, and you can't really be expected to love something, somebody that you have no relationship with. I have to say that, but people say that they fall in love with their baby when they're inside their tummy. If I haven't seen someone's face, I don't know what their personality is going to be like. I don't know anything about them other than the diameter of their head. How can I love the 15 centimeters or whatever it is?
I had the same experience. Yeah, I struggled.
And then when they come out, it's you don't see like a human. That it's a noise, and it's like there's no characteristics. It's just a responsibility. And then the love, like, it builds over time. And I have to say, like, I'm really, really grateful for the fact that I've got to a place in my recovery where I'm really good. And Leo is really compass mentis, you know, like, he's really, he's clued up to everything, and he is like a sponge. So I love the fact that now we have an amazing relationship, and I feel like it's really a pivotal point. But having said that, you know, there are, I think it's the thing of there is no right or wrong, and we would have kind of made our way through. When times were tough, you know, even when he was one, I'm sure that there would be people that would say that is like a really important time in a baby's life. Like, we know that the early years are so important in a child's development from 0 to 5. And that was something that used to, it did panic me a lot, because I thought that I can't have what's going on with me ruin another individual's life as well. That doesn't seem fair. But he's completely unscathed. Kids are so resilient.
They really are.
He clings on to the best bits. He doesn't even see like the worst bits or the weird bits. And I think that another thing is that at the beginning, if I'd been completely well and normal, I probably would have jumped straight back into work. But I did spend more time in the house.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that I'm grateful for. And I had to really work at the relationship, which means I put in a lot, like when I could. So lots of those weird baby classes, which were not comfortable for me at the beginning. But I did try and do everything like swimming lessons to try and bring the love in.
And
I think that was good bonding time for us. He's cool.
And how are you now? Like, what's your journey with your both physical and mental health?
So yeah, mental health is in a really good spot.
Amazing.
Best it's been, and it does continue that way. Still blips, but actually the blips now are much less significant every time they happen. And I don't know whether it's just that you get used to them and so you really know how to handle them. Physically, but physically I'm good. But physically it's been, you know, a journey. I've had like some surgeries since the kind of the birth stuff, so it's been a bit of a roller coaster. I had my colon removed, so I've now got a stoma bag. That was unforeseen and a bit of a knock. But but this is actually the longest that I've been. Oh my God, touch wood. I'm on a really good streak. I haven't been in hospital now for like 9 months, which is really good. Aww. And so I just want to get to a year. And I mentioned at the beginning, like I went on this holiday with my family and I hadn't been on an aeroplane for a while. So that feels like a really positive step.
I think that we are given challenges to serve others. And I think you fulfill that purpose so beautifully. And you are helping so many people, me included, feel inspired. And you put life in perspective, honestly. I think hearing your story reminds me of what's important. And I think that it's very easy to go through life stressing about this or that. And actually, when you hear the real experiences that people go through, people like you, it just actually reminds you, like, fuck yeah, I have to really be grateful. And that is a true gift that you're giving people. And I'm sorry that it happened to you. I truly am. And I wish it hadn't. But I want you to know that the experience gives a lot of people a hope and a completely different perspective of life.
Thank you, Rox.
So thank you. I'm so excited to ask you this question because I don't think there's anyone better I could ask it to. What does rising mean to you?
Oh, do you ask everyone this?
We ask everyone at the end.
I think rising to me, it feels like knowing that there are lots of things that can happen to someone that are these sort of bad chapters in their life. The things that you can't control, just the things that are down to luck, and being able to move through them with the trust and the faith that there is something, this like umbrella above, and whatever that looks like to you, whether it's something spiritual that will help you like pull out of it. I don't know. I'm like visualizing something like bigger.
Faith.
It is faith. Mm. And it's the thing that can't really be put into words. Yeah. So very hard to describe, that will take care of you and that will lead to the thing that is best for you.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. Louise, thank you so much for being such an amazing guest. Wow. I'm sure all of you are probably feeling the same as me. That was such an incredibly moving and inspiring story. And I am so grateful to Louise for sharing it with all of us. I can't be easy to kind of relive some of those moments, but it really, I know will help so many of you, and it definitely helped me. And I just think she is so incredible. I mean, she for me is the definition of someone who has risen. It can't be easy to relive those moments. And so I really think, you know, I just have so much immense gratitude for her to be willing to show up and do that for us. My gosh, I can't wait for you guys to listen to it. I can't wait to hear what you guys thought, what you took away from it. Please, please do follow, subscribe, rate, leave comments. It really, really does mean the world to all of us here at Rise with Roxy. Until next time, keep rising.